The Battle of Bosworth had just finished, and the victor of that battle composed a letter to be sent out far and wide. It was the first official proclamation of this new ruler to the land he had conquered. And when it arrived in London, the residents of our city could read and hear, so to speak, the words of their new ruler for the first time. Quote, Henry, by the grace of God, King of England and of France, Prince of Wales and Lord of Ireland, strictly charges and commandeth, upon pain of death, that no manner of man rob or spoil no manner of commons coming from the field, but suffer them to pass home to their counties and dwelling places with their horses and harness. And moreover, that no manner of man take upon him to go to no gentleman's place, neither in the country nor within cities nor boroughs, nor pick no quarrels for old or new matters, but keep the king's peace upon pain of hanging. And moreover, the king ascertaineth you that Richard, Duke of Gloucester, lately called King Richard, was lately slain at a place called Sandiford, within the Shire of Leicester, and there was laid openly, that every man might see and look upon him. And also there was slain upon the same field John, late Duke of Norfolk, John, late Earl of Lincoln, Thomas, late Earl of Surrey, Francis, Viscount Lovell, Sir Walter de Villiers, Lord Ferrers, Richard Ratcliffe, Knight, Robert Bradchley, Knight, and many other knights, squires and gentlemen, on whose soul God have mercy. Unquote. The speed at which this letter was written is proven in the mistakes that it makes. The battle is referred to as Sandiford, not Bosworth. And Thomas, Earl of Surrey, was actually not dead. He was gravely injured, but he would survive. So while that letter was not written during the heat of battle, it was written damn soon afterwards. And this was because Henry Tudor was moving fast. He had to consolidate the realm. He sent a man called Robert Willoughby up to Yorkshire to secure the person of Edward the Earl of Warwick, the 15-year-old son of George the Duke of Clarence, and technically the heir of the House of York. And Willoughby was to move him to the Tower of London, where the young 15-year-old was destined to spend the rest of his life. Orders were then sent to London. In the Tower, placed there by Richard III, had been Elizabeth of York, Henry Tudor's intended bride, and she was hastily placed into her mother's custody. And with these orders also came a warning. Henry Tudor, the new king, was on his way to the city. London's aldermen and city fathers responded to this rather chaotic and surprising turn of events by falling back at what had seen him through the previous century's political turmoil, pageantry. London loved its rituals and its rites, and it knew how to put on a good show like nobody else. Following established routines and protocols, the mayor, the grocer Thomas Hill, proclaimed the news to the city on the 26th of August, and the aldermanic court stepped up patrols of men in red and white striped livery of the city to keep the peace, as they've been doing since Mayor Henry Boleyn had militarily kept the peace, as we covered back in chapter 163. The city prepared. On the third day of September, 1485, the mayor led out the aldermen and city leaders, arrayed in the livery of the worshipful companies, and the aldermanic council to Shoreditch, where they met the newly arrived royal party. Here, King Henry was serenaded by trumpets and a poet reciting verses to celebrate the moment. Henry entered the city then in formal procession, and the crowds came out to meet him, cheering and showering the victor of the recent war with adulation and popular acclaim. They always did this. As we've seen in previous chapters, London always put on a good show in these times. I mean, sure, no one had any idea who this guy was, let alone what kind of king he would be. So why take the risk? Huh? Smile and wave, boys. Smile and wave. With the roar of the city in his ears, Henry Tudor, Henry VII, made his way to the one building that dominated all the others in the city, the gigantic, towering Leviathan of St. Paul's, with its massive steeple soaring hundreds of feet into the sky. Proceeding at once there, Henry deposited three war banners, freshly brought from the scene of his triumph, and placed them on display to be blessed and sanctified by the bevy of clerics, deans, and prebendary figures of that cathedral. One of these banners displayed the arms of the Syrian saint, who'd been adopted by many European nobles as a most martial saint due to his career as a Roman legionnaire, Saint George of Aleppo. One banner had the red fiery dragon on white and green background, representing his Welsh heritage, even if that was partly for show. And the third was the banner of Tartaron and Duncow. The what? Tartaron was French for crab, and that was meant to symbolise France, and it was emblazoned with a dun cow to represent the House of Warwick. Here, Henry was using it to point out that he was descended from Margaret Beaufort, and as such, no, he really, really is royalty. Honestly. This done, Henry knelt. Prayers and benedictions were placed upon him, and he joined in with the cathedral's preferred ritual in such circumstances, the singing of a Te Deum, a celebratory hymn of praise and glory. And then he retired. Not to Westminster, not there, not yet. Henry Tudor retired to the place used by Henry VI when he was brought to London as a Earl of Warwick's prisoner. Henry Tudor exited the cathedral and just turned to his right, where the splendid palace of the Bishop of London was able to provide him with his first true kingly accommodation. And here, in the precincts of St. Paul's, in the heart of the city of London, Henry Tudor began his reign, his first night where he slept on a formal king's bed in a formal king's chamber. And around him, as Grafton wrote, quote, plays, pastimes and pleasures were held in every part of the city, unquote. And what no one knew at the time was that it is now that we begin to chronicle the tale of the dynasty he was to produce. This is an opening image of the first Tudor king, and this is a good place to start the sixth book of our tale. Hi there, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city, travelling along at a fair pace, but stopping along the way to stare at interesting things. We have completed what is usually called the saga of the city in the medieval period, and now begin to really see the transition into what is universally known as the early modern period, the time when the state and the city within it was to take on the trappings that are recognisable to us. And with that in mind, we now enter the opening years of Henry VII's reign, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to chapter 176 of this story of London, Sudor Angelicus. We begin, as always, in London. The new regime was taking over. And over in Upper Thames Street, the new king had already started making changes. There was a mansion there, known as Cold Harbour, which had been given to the Royal College of Arms as their headquarters by King Richard III only a few years previously. But now it was repossessed by the new regime, and Henry had given it as a gift to his mother, the formidable Lady Margaret Beaufort. This amazing woman now lavished attention upon the large house and installed within it the 18-year-old daughter of the former King Edward IV, Elizabeth of York. Henry VII would then visit the young lady on occasion during the first few months, her mother in attendance, while downriver in Westminster a veritable legion of master craftsmen descended upon the palace to redecorate it. In keeping with the new regime, a new propaganda campaign was being started here in the very structure of that building. These men would paint and carve upon the walls, both inside and out, the new symbols of the new regime, the iconography of the new king. And it is here we begin to see the first uses of the double rose motif, the red rose and the white rose combined together in the Tudor rose, a powerful new symbology. There were other new things that the king was bringing in. Having spent almost all his adult life in France, Henry Tudor had seen something over there that he rather wanted over here. The French kings had, since 1445, been protected by two companies of Scotsmen, 100 men-at-arms and just over 100 archers. These were the king's bodyguard and were dressed resplendently and really did look the part. Henry Tudor, after the battle that would become known as Bosworth, decided he wanted a bit of that, so he decided to create his own version of this chic new French-style security, by forming the Yeomen of the Guard. Today, we tend to call them the Beefeaters. While today these are mostly awesome ex-service people in the Tower of London, back in 1485 they were very much still active servicemen, and some had a long history with Henry already. See, our first problem when talking about the formation of the Yeomen of the Guards is that our records of the earliest days are somewhat few and far between. Back in 1809, there was a fire in St. James's Palace, wherein much of the early records of the order were kept. And this has forced historians to try to piece together what evidence does remain still to try and replicate what was going on with the Yeomen of the Guard. Where we find the earliest records of the Yeomen then is in other court records. For example, less than 4 weeks after the Battle of Bosworth, and over a month before Henry got crowned, Henry VII appointed a man called John Fry to be the royal searcher of the port of Bristol, a lucrative customs job. But that document refers to Fry as a, quote, yeoman of the King's Guard, unquote. Another document of this time mentions a man called William Brown, again mentioned as a, quote, yeoman of our guard, unquote, who's made a bailiff of a small village up in Warwickshire. So we can say with some surety that, guess what? The Yeomen of the Guard existed immediately after the victory of Henry VII and were part of his regime from the get-go. Based on records like these, we begin to see who these royal bodyguards were. There were Welshmen like Owen ap Gruffydd and Richard ap Philip. There were veterans of Bosworth like Henry and John Kerr, William Cheeseman and John Edwards. And there were men who had served, quote, overseas, unquote, which was shorthand for saying they had been with Henry Tudor, as he was exiled for all those years in Brittany, men like Thomas Fulbrook and Ypres Lloyd. Now, there had been previous royal bodyguards, orders known as the Yeomen of the Crown and the Yeomen of the Chamber. But all evidence suggests that what was created was a new order of bodyguards, and that these men, in the words of historian Anita Herridine, quote, created by Henry VII to be in constant attendance. It was adopted from existing structures within the household. The king evidently took care not to abolish the older offices of yeoman of the crown and yeoman of the chamber, but combined them with his new retinue, which perhaps he regarded as a form of modernization, fashioning on a French model. The members of the guard were selected for their proven loyalty as well as for their strength and martial skills. With the exception of Richard II, it was probably the largest bodyguard that any English king had in peacetime. Although the yeomen were assigned to certain duties in the personal service of the king, the ancient protective function of yeoman of the crown was specifically retained for the new corps. A greater prominence was given to this guard by using it also as a splendidly arrayed retinue, wearing the Tudor livery, to enhance the reputation of the court and its ruler. The role of the guard, however, extended far beyond the confines of the household of the court, its individual members being involved in many aspects of royal activities, both in peace and in war, unquote. And now, around these finely dressed French-style bodyguards, Henry VII quickly began assembling men who he trusted, men who he could depend upon to run things for him, and these men were to become the stable core of his new government's regime. John, Lord Denham, became the Treasurer of England. Thomas Lovell became Chancellor of the Exchequer. You saw Richard Bray made Chancellor of the County Palatinate and the Duchy of Lancaster. The likes of Richard Fox, already the King's Secretary and, quote, beloved Counsellor, unquote, became the Bishop of Exeter and then Keeper of the Privy Seal. Christopher Urswick became the King's Almoner. And you also saw a man called John Morton, who was made the all-powerful Chancellor of England, go on to become the Archbishop of Canterbury, and then finally a Cardinal in 1493, a grand trio of titles he would hold until his death around 1500. Meanwhile, London got on with the job of preparing for the coronation. Clearly no expense would be spared to make this as majestic and as regal as any previous coronation. This being said, it was still being organised a tad hastily. The ceremony was fundamentally identical to Richard III's. So while Henry Tudor had wanted new things, he didn't have time to update the rituals of coronation. London itself, however, was carrying on, around and away from these changes in the court. The city had a life of its own, a rhythm of its own. It did not need nor care for the comings and goings of those grand men to be able to maintain itself. And in 1485, or thereabouts, I'm not 100% sure, down in London, a wedding took place. A mercer called Thomas Windout married a woman called Catherine, the daughter of Thomas Norlande, who was a London grocer and also an alderman and also a former sheriff of the city. The couple had married in the church of St. Atholine's. Now, long-time listeners of this podcast will know that name well. It was the parish of this church that had seen locally-based spice dealers come together to form the parish fraternity of St. Atholine, the quasi-guild that had not only been the driving force behind the development of the long-lost medieval shopping emporium of Soper's Lane, as we covered all the way back in chapter 108, but this fraternity had gone on to become the foundation of the mighty Grocers' Company. From a mercantile perspective, this church was one steeped in history. St. Atholine's itself was physically, like most of the other churches in London, rather compact and small, with a neat tower and some very striking stained glass windows. It had long sat, discreet and solid, on Budge Row, a constant made of stone, surrounded by ever-changing buildings. Founded in the 12th century, its role in the evolution of the Grocers' Company had meant that it saw the city pay for its rebuilding in and around 1400. And yet, in spite of this, over the myriad generations, dozens of other rich grocers and ropers, rich benefactors and parishioners with stalls in Soper's Lane had left their impact upon this building. They had paid to repair the fabrics on the altars and tabernacles. They had paid for new side chapels to be constructed for devotional prayers. They had engaged master craftsmen to illuminate the inside with stained glass, which spoke of the parishioners' wealth and their devotion to God. And they had come here to enact their myriad ceremonies, strong Catholics one and all, whose faith dictated who they were. Here they baptized their children, here they buried their dead, filling the compact church with tombs and memorial plaques. St. Atholine's was a place in London that was very here and very real and contemporary, yet where the city's history could be felt by all those who entered it. And it was here that Thomas Windout had come to marry his wife, Catherine Norlande, a mercer and a grocer's daughter. Something as commonplace and as London as you can imagine. But in the story of Thomas Windout, we gain a small insight. In his story, we see London of this time illuminated just a little brighter, like a stained glass window catching the sun from behind a cloud on a December morning, dazzling us with unexpected richness. Thomas was not born of this city. Like many residents, he'd been adopted by London. He'd originated up in Hertfordshire. His parents are buried in a small village called Buntingford. Their son had come south to seek his fortune and to make himself. London's siren song upon the young of England, then as now, never ending. By 1485, London was a city of immigrants, some of whom would turn up and immediately slip between the wide cracks in the streets, descending into poverty and destitution. But others would land on their feet. Thomas was one of those. He'd come to London to be one of those who were determined to make himself as an apprentice. And more than that, he would be an apprentice in the growing and mighty Mercer's Company. If coming to London with a place as an apprentice already arranged marked you as lucky, then if that apprenticeship was in the incredibly powerful Mercer's Company, that would mark you as more lucky. And if that's the case, then luckiest of all, Thomas Windout found that not only was he joining the Mercer's Company, but that his master was none other than Henry Colette, a very powerful member of the Mercer's Company. Colette had become alderman for Farringdon Ward Without back in 1476, and one of the sheriffs of London a year later. His rise in London's politics had continued over the intervening years, and in 1483, he'd just been moved to become the alderman of the strategically important Castle Baynard's Ward, where Richard III had based himself in London. And next year, as 1485 becomes 1486, his rise in power would be complete, because he was going to be the newly elected mayor of London. And to celebrate it, he would pay for the renovation of the huge cross on Cheapside. Henry Colet was also a parishioner of St. Atheline's. And there's no doubt there'd be some symbolic importance that in the time of his rise, one of his apprentices was marrying a grocer's daughter, marking his own rise in respectability and success within the confines of London society. But Thomas Windout's rise to this moment had not been smooth. He had had to struggle to make himself. The path before such young men was often fraught and difficult. First, he would have had to have survived his apprenticeship, that decade-long period where he was to show he could learn, he was diligent, he was worth investing time upon. In this, the key to the success depended upon the core relationship between the apprentice and the master. See, an apprentice was usually a teenage boy and basically ended up becoming an additional member of his master's household, often little more than a member of his extended family. Henry Colet and his wife were to have 22 children between them, and as such, to mark himself as an apprentice worth investing time and effort in such a noisy and large household, Thomas Windout would have had to have applied himself diligently, showing something that made him worth Paulette's time. The fact that he was to become successful shows that he managed to do this. And he certainly had gained the freedom of the Mercer's Company, becoming acknowledged as a journeyman mercer, and able to start his career as a merchant. In such things, however, the young freeman would need the right kind of sponsorship and advice to survive the ruthless waters of London's mercantile market, as well as having those who were willing to trust him with money. And here, having a former master like Paulette would have been invaluable, opening doors for him. Ah, Thomas, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And yet, as he began his career then, Thomas Windout seemed set for a steady rise, except he made a very foolish mistake. Back in 1478, Thomas Windout, newly made Mercer merchant, owed, formally, £540 to a fellow London mercer called John Llewellyn for some cloth that he had bought. Over in the great trading emporium of Antwerp, Thomas and John drew up a contract about the terms of the repayment of the outstanding amount. Everything fine and dandy. And yet in that contract was a strange sentence. Windout would pay the money back, quote, "at the time that I, the said Thomas Windout, mercer, be wedded unto the wife of Thomas Shelley, mercer of London," unquote. So yeah, the repayment would begin when Windout married Mistress Shelley, taking from her goods and materials to pay the 540 in full. You know, nothing, no, there's a problem. Because Thomas Shelley, her husband, was at that exact time alive and well. And he and his wife seemed happy enough. And this repayment contract, how could Thomas Windout marry his wife? Unless, you know, she was a widow. You know, something happened to Thomas Shelley. Maybe a little accident. It was a troubling document. It contained within it a subtle threat and a hint of conspiracy. How would Windout be able to marry Mistress Shelley without getting her husband out of the way first? It appeared to be a legally binding contract to commit murder. Now, Thomas Shelley himself was not a stupid man. He got wind of this contract, and he immediately responded. And he responded very intelligently. He wrote about it to the king. In late 1479, King Edward IV sent a firm letter to the Mercer's Company of London. He said the obvious, "Guys, this looks like a murder plot." After all, the contract could not be made valid, quote, "but upon assurance," unquote, of Thomas Shelley's death. Their letter went on to say, quote, "whereby it may appear evidently that the said bargain has fully conspired and imagined his said death," unquote. Thomas Windout was now in serious, serious trouble. Now, based on the power of the guild, and possibly because Thomas Shelley was a long-standing member of the Mercers, the king had agreed to his request that everything about this should be sorted in-house, that the Mercers could solve the issue without public scandal. The king went sure, but he did remind the Mercers that if they did not deal with this to his satisfaction, he would intervene, and this matter would go public. Thus, it was only about 8 weeks later that the Mercers came together in February 1480 to investigate, quote, the diverse controversies, stirs, debates and demands of late had and sprung, unquote, between Shelley and Windout. And here, Windout's luck seemed to have held out for the young man. This court of elder Mercers, one of whom was none other than his former master Henry Colette, ruled that the agreement had been made by Windout out of a great, quote, simpleness, unquote. It was a word that the senior officers of the company had chosen very carefully. It suggested the motive was not malice, just naivety, ignorance, stupidity. As much as you could suggest that this was merely face-saving to cover up for the Mercers, it is worth noting that sat alongside Colette in judgment of the young man was Thomas Shelley himself. Had Thomas Windout been infatuated with his wife? Had he spoken of this as a blag, a way of making himself seem grander and bigger? The young man had used his charm to get credit for £540 in the first place, blagging, cocksure and confident, and ultimately very stupid. It does seem that way. And as such, to stand before his peers like this, no, it's worse, they're not his peers, they're his masters. These are the men who had succeeded in doing what he was trying to do, who had made their journeys to the top of their profession, who were in their own way masters of this very small universe. To be brought before them like this and declared simple, that was crushing, humiliating. And it got worse. Justice in London was often based upon humiliation by your peers. And in this punishment, Thomas Windout suffered great humiliation indeed. The Mercers demanded he get upon his knees and beg forgiveness for his stupidity to Master and Mistress Shelley. An act of humiliating contrition. But that was not all. While he could gain over £400 in credit, obviously this young man's personal wealth was not large. Unless they reinforce this lesson upon him with a huge fine, one for £40, 30 of which were to be paid for the Shelleys for their inconvenience, and then £10 to the Mercers for basically being an idiot. This was the kind of incident that could ruin a young man's career as a merchant. But, chastened and perhaps more wise, young Thomas Windout had learned his lesson and kept his nose clean and put his head down, and the humiliation of 1480, while it may have held him back a little, he certainly seemed to have overcome. And so it is here in 1485 we see him marrying the respectable daughter of a grocer in St. Atheline's Church, his own career as a mercer and a civic leader now back on track. We're going to call in again to Thomas Windout as the years progress, his being a single story within the wider city, but it is rather interesting. Of course, there is another bigger London-wide story that the city cared about right now, because while all of this was going on, London was dealing with something much more terrifying. It had a myriad of names. Pseudo Angelicus, the English sweat, the stoop gallant, or just the sweats. Some called it the French disease, as they believed it had come over from the continent with Henry Tudor's soldiers. But today, we just tend to call it the sweating sickness. This was a mysterious and sudden malady that came from nowhere, it seemed, and stalked England with a sudden lethal mortality, striking down its victims fast, insanely fast. It was said if you caught this disease, 12 hours later you would either have recovered and be thanking God for a miracle, or you'd be dead. What is sweating sickness? We do not know. At all. To this day, there are hosts of competing theories as to what exactly this pathogen was. And while probable consensus has been reached, epidemiologists still disagree over the precise details. Some have said it was caused by sewage contamination. Others suggested ergot in bread. There have been claims that it was caused by anthrax in raw woolen fleeces. The most commonly held theorem is that it was a variation of a hantavirus, a zoonotic infection carried in rodents and jumping species to infect humans. But even then, this description doesn't match the actual profile of the disease. What we do know for sure is what it did to its victims. The first symptom was a sudden sense of dread, of great anxiety or apprehension. Soon after, the second symptom would hit, a violent chill. Victims would feel dizzy, develop a splitting headache, and followed by serious pain in the neck and shoulders, and this spread to their arms and the back, and cold shivers would rack their body. These cold shivers would grow in intensity, sometimes said to become violent, but in time, usually a couple of hours, but sometimes as fast as 30 minutes, this would pass, and the third symptom would begin. The victim would begin to feel warm. Their temperature would rise, the body burning with the infection, and they would start to profusely sweat. The headache would grow, often producing delirium and an intense, demanding thirst. Victims were said to be tearing off their clothes, desperate to cool down. The heart rate would begin to increase dramatically, often leading to palpitations and/or chest pains. There would be 6 or 7 hours of this, and victims would be left feeling exhausted. And now came the final symptom, where the victim would have a terrible urge to sleep. Some physicians at the time thought that if this was allowed, that would be the end of them, as many who collapsed from exhaustion then passed out and never woke again. But if you stayed awake and persevered, after about 12 hours, you could make it. The temperature would drop, the heart would slow, and the headache would leave. Survivors would be exhausted, drained, like they'd just been hit by a viral truck, somewhat bewildered. And the really savage thing was, having an attack offered you no immunity to the sickness. You could get it again. And several victims caught it several times, enduring the sudden blast of symptoms again and again until one subsequent strike, they fell victim to it. It tended to spike in cases during the summer and the autumn and was known to impact on those between 35 and 45 years old, worst of all. We do not have much to go on despite the savagery of the outbreak, which did impact upon rural communities far more than England's urban communities. But with that being said, the one place we do know was impacted badly upon was London. We see the impact of the sweating sickness on London plainly in the mortality it inflicted upon the mayors of London. In 1485, Mayor Thomas Hill, the grocer, suddenly caught the disease and dropped dead from an attack. He was replaced by the draper, William Stoker, but he caught the infection and died 4 days later. The grocer was replaced in office by a goldsmith, but he then avoided London, and then another grocer took over and the normal October turning off this post. We know 6 aldermen of London died in the same time, along with thousands of other residents, and it was subsequently believed that the vast crowds in London for the coronation of Henry VII caught this disease and spread it across the land. We have no evidence of this, but again, that's not actually important. What is important is that many said it at the time they believed it, and as such, the underlying sense that this reign would be ill-omened began to spread amidst some. Still, regardless of the disease, London, as we saw, continued, and that grand coronation took place. Henry Tudor moved into the Tower of London just prior to this, before processing out of there into the city. This grand royal progression crossed London to Westminster, as it had done in every other coronation, and it allowed the new royal court fill the streets with pageantry, but also, just as equally, for London to respond in kind. This had been the city that had celebrated Henry V, that had gloried Edward III, that had cheered Henry II. They knew how to make kings feel special. The procession was majestic as it made its way along Cheapside. At the front were the heralds and sergeant-at-arms, the esquires of the body, probably, but we have no records of them, the newly formed yeomen of the guard. Then came the king's secretary and almoner, and then John Ward, a grocer, the newly elected mayor of London, and then after them came the earls of Derby and Nottingham and the earls of Oxford and Lincoln, and then Henry VII. He wasn't wearing anything on his head as he rode through Cheapside, but it was noted he was wearing a long gown of purple velvet edged with ermine, and he rode slowly under a royal canopy supported by 4 knights on foot. The crowd witnessed Henry follow the traditional route, down through London, out of Bishopsgate, along the road past the Grand Templar headquarters, or where it used to be the temple, which is now run by the Knights of St. John, towards the second of the two great crosses erected by a previous king, the Charing Cross. Here Henry swung left, still surrounded by crowds from London western suburbs, and head south, entering Westminster and her own crowds, before moving on to the palace and the next door's abbey. The traditional ceremony took place, the consecration and the crowning, the taking of the oath, and the acclamation over. Henry, now King de Gracia, accompanied and supported by all his entourage, emerged from the abbey and travelled back again to the Tower of London. I think the Londoners may have enjoyed it, and we know there were large crowds there, but they may have been a bit disappointed to hear that the Grand Coronation Tournament, which was supposed to happen on the following Sunday, was postponed to November 13th. That was because on the following Monday, Henry was to meet his first Parliament. A brief digression, which, while it has little to do with London specifically, was an important moment in this Parliament. You see, previous to this moment, Henry Tudor had suffered under an Act of Attainder. This meant he was forbidden from holding the office of King of England. There had to be some parliamentary and legal shenanigans enacted for him to get over this, but he did so with some aplomb. Parliament ruled that the attainder had been nullified the moment he'd become king, and that he had become king the moment Richard III had died, and now he was king in his own right. He also decided to surprise many by not claiming the throne because of the rights granted to him via his wife Elizabeth of York, but on his own right. His claim via the Bufords was enough. So, for the record, this meant his mother was Margaret Buford, his grandfather John Buford, the Duke of Somerset, his father was also called John Buford, he was the Earl of Somerset, and his father before him was John of Gaunt, the son of Edward III. That was enough for Henry to claim the throne and kind of eyeball anybody who would even hint of anything different. It was a big step, but it saw the day one, and then he had Parliament lift the Acts of Attainder on his supporters who had suffered for them so, and then unleashed his own retribution upon those who had been stalwarts of Richard III. The new regime had proper legal basis now, and subsequently set about establishing a stable and strong rule upon England. If the previous few decades had taught the English anything, it was that the erosion of law and order had done much to destabilise the government regimes of the last 30 years. And because of this, Henry summoned a sidebar meeting over at the Benedictine headquarters, the vast monastery of Blackfriars, where all the royal justices were asked to assemble, and basically told them to think of as many statutes that were profitable to the realm and ask if they could enforce them. And the question was, how were they to be enforced? Henry VII wanted and needed law and order and the perception of impartial king's justice to be cemented at the heart of his regime going forward. And yet, for London and the Londoners, such things, while sure, they're important, what bothered the richer oligarchs of the city was something else. What bothered them was trade. And here things were far more ambiguous and far more complicated. And while the trade policy of Henry VII in his first few years in power usually does not make much headway in the traditional biographies of this first Tudor monarch, they were crucially important to our city, vital even. And we need to see them through the prism of the powerhouse of London's merchants right now, the Mercers' Company, whose view on things was everything. To understand why trade in London was to cause the city to find itself at odds with the new regime, it is worth remembering who the principal players are as we start. Now, newer listeners need to know the lay of the land, and long-time listeners consider this a brief resetting of the table. If you have followed the story so far, you have heard of the numerous twists and turns in all of these groups' history over the preceding years. But at the start of the Tudor Age, firstly, we had the Worshipful Company of Mercers, the principal merchanting guild in London. The Mercers were financially dominant and politically powerful, emerging out of the shadows of the previously more powerful Grocers of London to become the main powerhouse guild, and from whom the aldermen and mayors of London were often dictated. A spin-off from them was a newly emergent group, the Merchant Adventurers. The Adventurers were an enterprising and entrepreneurial body, utterly dominated by members of the guild, It wasn't a guild by itself at this point. This body allowed members of other guilds, and usually the richer ones who had earned enough money to invest into the import and export of English cloth to the continent, become joint partners, sharing the costs and diminishing the many risks. The adventurers were an adjunct of the Mercers, but they were technically their own people. Several members of them wanted to be a livery company in their own right, and they ruthlessly enforced their monopoly on English trade exports, being granted the rights to enforce the said monopoly on the continent in the great trade emporium of Europe at the time, Antwerp. Rivals to the Mercers, the Grocers' Company, were in decline right now. Crucially, they had become, as we explored over the last few chapters, the bedrock of Yorkist support in the city. The Grocers had steered London to defy Henry VI and had hoped to reap dividends when Edward IV had taken the throne. Alas, the king in his greed had not brought them the benefits they had thought, and the rise of Antwerp and the merchants' adventurers had seen their fortunes wane. And they were now reduced to bickering with the Mercers over who got to stand in the most high-profile place in St. Paul's Cathedral. Finally, there was the older version of the merchant adventurers, the Staplers, the wool exporters of London. The Staplers ran wool to the compulsory market in Calais to sell on, but the rise of Antwerp had seen the Calais market, so crucial to them, lose trade, and the Staplers, once the dominant political group in London, were weaker, increasingly dominated by the Mercers and locked out of trade to Antwerp by the adventurers. These are the four factions which dominate London's trade, and by dominating trade, they dominated the revenues into London, and by dominating the revenues into London, they dominated the concerns of the richer oligarchs of the city. So while Londoners, the rank and file of citizens, may have been more focused on things like the deadly disease that was killing everyone, and who the hell are these foreigners from places like Yorkshire coming into the city and taking our jobs? And maybe things like, did you hear about that Mercer who said he'd murder a fellow Mercer to marry his wife? For the political class, trade was everything. Got that? Awesome. So let's begin. We get into what was going to be a small moment that actually had big implications. Back on the 20th of August of 1485, the merchant adventurers of London were informed to their delight that two of their ships, one called the George Cobham and another called the Trinity of Lynn, had returned to London from the Low Countries safely, despite the dangers of sea from weather and piracy. They began the usual rituals of working out the profits of the voyage and distributing the goods, when only 3 days later they'd been told the result of the Battle of Bosworth and that a new king was in place. And this was an issue. See that old king, Richard III? He was the brother of the Dowager Duchess of Burgundy. And now the Duchess of Burgundy had seen her brother killed by the man who'd taken England. And this was worrying the adventurers how it was going to affect their trade going forward for the immediate future. I mean, if you think about it from their point of view, this new king had taken the throne with money and soldiers from France, which was a nation at loggerheads with the ruler of the Low Countries. The previous problems with Burgundy, focused on the ever-increasing rates of piracy and the instability caused by the civil war in the Low Countries, had seen the adventurers hope they had resolved it. And how they'd resolved it? Well, Richard III had authorised a formal embassy to that region, wherein the governor of the merchant adventurers, John Wendy, and the London alderman Hugh Clopton had travelled over and negotiated on behalf of the Crown, and also on behalf of the Mercers. So they're now asking themselves, Richard III is gone, what would relations with the Low Country look like? What made the matters worse was that the current trade agreements with that region expired on the 2nd of January 1486, one of the very first issues before the new king was renewing them. And the question was, would he? Would he not? He did so on January 1st, 1486, but he extended the conditions in the deal for only 1 year, which did very little to calm the worry of the merchant adventurers. He planned a meeting in Calais with the husband of the Duchess of Burgundy, the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian Habsburg. But there was great doubt this would happen, and the adventurers were so worried, they began keeping a lot of their assets in the continent just in case. And as 1486 came to an end, Henry VII did extend the treaty for another year. But soon after, on February 20th, Henry tore up this renewal and said he'd only be extending it for 6 months, and he considered changing his mind even then. And what was causing this were events taking place over in Calais and the continent. And once again, Calais, the last English possession in Europe, was to have an overlarge impact upon London. As we've covered before, Calais was the location of a large English garrison. During the recent civil wars, it had been the largest garrison of troops, and under the control of the Earl of Warwick, had also become a bastion of piracy as much as trade. Because Calais was a compulsory wool market used for the sale of this commodity by the staplers, the upkeep of the garrison had been paid for by the profits of the staplers, and because of this, London and Calais were forever linked intimately. So to explain the rather amazing events that were going down. See, out in Europe, there was growing opposition to this new regime of Henry VII. While we know the Wars of the Roses are over, to people at the time, Henry VII's regime could maybe only last as long as Richard III's. There were still factions, and the Yorkist faction, the original faction as Lancasterian was only title used later in those 11 civil wars, was still a force. The key to it all was Richard III's sister, Margaret, the Duchess of Burgundy. Her first husband had died, and the actual title of Duchy of Burgundy had been lost to France. But the rest of her demesne was a massive area that covered what we would call modern Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. Margaret's young stepdaughter, Mary, had inherited the duchy and then married Maximilian Habsburg. She then died as a result of a riding accident, leaving her four-year-old son Philip as heir. The Burgundian nobles now regarded Margaret as the regent of Burgundy, so she held a lot of power, and she was prepared to use it to support her Yorkist family in ousting Henry Tudor, newly established, from the throne. Meanwhile, back in England, following the Battle of Bosworth, the Earl of Lincoln was reconciled with Henry VII, and he was allowed his freedom. But the young Earl of Warwick, as I said, was placed in the Tower of London. Despite appearing to be loyal to Henry, Lincoln and the other diehard Yorkists now began conspiring to oust Henry from the throne. Sometime around now, supposedly a pro-Yorkist priest discovered a 10-year-old boy called Lambert Simnel, who bore a strong resemblance to the Earl of Warwick, who's locked up in the Tower of London. Having taught the boy some royal etiquette, the priest then took that 10-year-old boy over to Ireland, where the Lord Deputy was the Earl of Kildare, a hardcore sympathiser for the Yorkist cause. He and others started conspiring to put about the story that Simnel was actually the Earl of Warwick and he had escaped from the Tower, and that the person being held in the Tower was merely an imposter. About now, the Earl of Lincoln escaped to Burgundy to seek the support of his aunt, Margaret of Burgundy. Viscount Lovell, who was already at Margaret's court, having fled there after leading an earlier failed Yorkist uprising, met him and offered his support. It's unlikely that Margaret of Burgundy believed that Simnel was the real Earl of Warwick, but she probably supported the conspirators in the hope that, were Henry VII to be defeated, either Lincoln or the real Warwick might end up wearing the crown. Thus, the seeds of rebellion began to be sown over in the Regent of Burgundy's court in Melchelin. Now, how Calais comes into this is pretty long-winded. Calais, of course, had been a Yorkist bastion for years, and in March 1485, Richard III had made it so that his illegitimate son, John of Gloucester, became captain of Calais. Richard had known the importance of Calais and wanted to ensure it remained in loyal hands, so who better than his bastard son, who Richard described in the patent of the appointment as, quote, our dear bastard son, unquote. John of Gloucester was only about 17 at the time of the appointment, but he had lived in Calais for several months previously. He knew the town's garrison and its merchants, and he did run it completely. John, however, was removed from office soon after Henry VII seized the throne, but rather than actually be persecuted, he was given a pension for about £20 a year, probably at the instigation of his cousin Elizabeth, who was King Henry's new wife. In March 1486, Henry VII put Giles de Bouny in charge of Calais. He was a former Yorkist who had changed allegiance to Henry Tudor. Following the Duke of Buckingham's rebellion, de Bouny had actually fled to Brittany to be with Henry and had been attained by Richard III. Having proved himself fiercely loyal to Henry VII, he was made a baron and given the important job of running Calais, but with the lesser title of Lieutenant of Calais rather than Captain of Calais. De Bouny was also master of the mint there, and he was used by Henry on diplomatic and other tasks, and as such he was unable to spend all his time in Calais, and this has probably meant that his appointment did not immediately stamp out all these Yorkist sympathies in the town. And that would explain why Thomas David, one of Calais's garrison captains, was able to take some of his men and join the Yorkist conspirators at Margaret's court in Machelin. So right now, before we go any further, because Calais is involved, due to the role of the grocers there, London's merchants are maybe not implicated, but they're adjacent to this. And that's on top of the merchant adventurers trading with Margaret's Burgundy. So they're adjacent to this as well. With the arrival of the Calais contingents and others, Margaret of Burgundy decided to launch an operation to overthrow Henry. She provided the Earl of Lincoln with money, ships and about 2,000 Flemish or German mercenaries, depending on who you read, who together with the other Yorkists set sail for Ireland, which had remained a hotbed of Yorkist support to raise even more aid. There the boy, Lambert Simnel, was paraded as the Earl of Warwick. And on the 24th of May, Whit Sunday, he was actually crowned King Edward VI of England in Dublin Cathedral. The 2,000 Yorkists who'd arrived there from Burgundy were now joined by about 4,000 troops already raised by the Earl of Kildare in readiness to invade England, and they sailed across the Irish Sea, landing on the Cumbrian coast and advancing south into the Midlands. The child at its head. As England baked under a hot sun, the Earl of Lincoln headed towards York to try and increase his army, which grew to about 8,000 men. At Tadchester, Viscount Lowell and 2,000 men conducted a night attack, which overwhelmed 400 loyalists under Lord Clifford, but that was to be about the height of their success. As ambitious as his army was, they were eventually met by Henry VII's battle-hardened and disciplined forces, numbering about 12,000 men. They caught up with them at a village of East Stoke near Newark. On the 14th of June 1487, a ferocious battle began which lasted for 3 hours and ended in the complete and bloody victory for King Henry. Most of the Yorkist leaders were killed, including Lincoln, but Lovell escaped, never to be heard of again. Lambert Simnel was captured, but Henry realised he was a mere puppet and granted him clemency, at the same time showing his contempt by employing him as a scullion in the royal kitchens. So with all of that going on, we have Henry Tudor now sitting there and looking at Burgundy and going, "You supported these arseholes, right?" And he would be within his rights to be somewhat annoyed at the region, and given that, consider now how he would be feeling about those mercers and merchants adventurers and London oligarchs who were endlessly saying things like, "Have you sorted out that trade agreement with Burgundy yet, Your Majesty?" The new king was not impressed, and London's merchants were set on a course that would make them butt heads with this new regime. And what's worse, they could not divert from the course. There was too much money involved. Their entire future depended on access to the Low Countries and Antwerp. And so with a rather heavy inevitability, London and the regime of Henry VII began to rub against one another, as we will see going forward. Still, relations were not all bad. There were things that happened in London at the time which would show London being useful for the king. So, for example, in 1486, you saw the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Morton, consecrated not in Canterbury Cathedral itself, but in Lambeth Palace, the first Archbishop to do so. But the year previously, in 1485, down in Westminster, the printer, William Caxton, was hard at work. After producing the best-selling Canterbury Tales, he decided to seek out a new bestseller from former classic English texts, and he happened upon and decided to print copies of Le Mort d'Arthur, Thomas Malory's classic account of the tale of King Arthur, the great mythic king of England, a robust and larger-than-life character who may have been based on Geoffrey of Monmouth's idealised version of King William II, as we covered back in Chapter 56. So, Caxton published a mass-produced copy of Malory's epic poem, and thus in 1486, the tales of King Arthur were popular across London and England, the grand romance of a once and future king. And as such, when Henry VII discovered that his wife, Elizabeth of York, was pregnant, he decided to tap right into this. Back then, the supposed site of Camelot was said to be in Winchester, and so the king sent his heavily pregnant wife to the convent of St. Swithin in Winchester, and there she did indeed give birth to a son, who the father promptly insisted should be named Arthur. The Tudor dynasty was secure. Arthur, the once and future king of the Tudors, was born. And for this king, the future seemed bright. even if for London the issues were only just beginning. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. The Story of London is a small podcast run by myself and thrives due to listener support. And support comes in many myriad ways. The biggest support you can give is, as I've said before, please ask me questions. I adore listeners asking questions, seeking clarifications and more. Sometimes entire episodes have been driven by questions asked by listeners in the past, and I happily encourage such things. If you're listening on Spotify, you can ask questions via the comments option at the end of the episode. If you're listening via Apple Podcasts, please feel free to ask questions in the comment sections of the podcast as well. And you can also find us on Blue Sky, where the Story of London has dared to gain a brief and small social media presence. If you wish to support us more, please feel free to leave us a 5-star review, or even better if you're an Apple, a positive verbal review. As again, this drives the unthinking AI algorithms that make podcasts work and make it be seen by even more wonderful listeners. And finally, if you are so inclined, you can support us on Buy Me a Coffee by making a small contribution to keep me caffeinated, or even become a member. And my gracious thanks to those members who help cover things like hosting fees and the mundane charges that you have to pay when running a podcast like this. And that's it. Book 6 carries on next week, and I'm planning to take time out of the unrelenting drive of history to stop for a moment and look around London at the start of the Tudor period. It promises to be interesting, but we'll see. Anyway, this is Saul, hoping you are safe, well, warm, and life is treating you kindly. I'll see you next week for another episode of The Story of London.